Ashendon by W. Somerset Maugham. Preface. This book is founded on my experiences in the intelligence department during the war, but rearranged for the purposes of fiction. Fact is a poor storyteller. It starts a story at haphazard, generally long before the beginning, rambles on inconsequently, and tails off, leaving loose ends hanging about without a conclusion. It works up to an interesting situation and then leaves it in the air to follow an issue that has nothing to do with the point. It has no sense of climax and whittles away its dramatic effects in irrelevance. There's a school of novelists that looks upon this as the proper model for fiction. If life, they say, is arbitrary and disconnected, why, fiction should be so too. For fiction should imitate life. In life, things happen at random, and that's how they should happen in a story. They don't lead to a climax, which is an outrage to probability. They just go on. Nothing offends these people more than the punch or the unexpected twist with which some writers seek to surprise their readers, and when the circumstances they relate seem to tend towards a dramatic effect, they do their best to avoid it. They don't give you a story. They give you the material on which you can invent your own. Sometimes it consists of an incident presented, you might think, at haphazard, and you're invited to divine its significance. Sometimes they give you a character and leave it at that. They give you the materials for a dish and expect you to do the cooking yourself. Now, this is one way, like another, of writing stories, and some very good stories have been written in it. Chekhov used it with mastery. It's more suitable for the very short story than for the longer one. The description of a mood, an environment, or an atmosphere can hold your attention for half a dozen pages, but when it comes to 50, a story needs a supporting skeleton. The skeleton of a story is, of course, its plot. Now, a plot has certain characteristics that you cannot get away from. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It is complete in itself. It starts with a set of circumstances which have consequences, but of which the causes may be ignored. And these consequences, in their turn, the cause of other circumstances, are pursued till a point is reached when the reader is satisfied that they are the cause of no further consequences that need be considered. This means that a story should begin at a certain point and end at a certain point. It should not wander along an uncertain line, but follow, from exposition to climax, a bold and vigorous curve. If you wanted to represent it diagrammatically, you would draw a semicircle. It's very well to have the element of surprise, and this punch, this unexpected twist, which the imitators of Chekhov despise, is only bad when it's badly done. When it's an integral part of the story and its logical issue, it is excellent. There's nothing wrong in a climax. It's a very natural demand of the reader. It's only wrong if it does not follow naturally from the circumstances that have gone before. It is purely an affectation to elude it, because in life, as a general rule, things tail off ineffectively. For it's quite unnecessary to treat as axiomatic the assertion that fiction should imitate life. It is merely a literary theory like another. There is, in fact, a second theory that is just as plausible, and this is that fiction should use life merely as raw material which it arranges in ingenious patterns. You have a very good analogy in painting. The landscape painters of the 17th century were not interested in the direct representation of nature, which to them was no more than the occasion for a formal decoration. They constructed a scene architecturally, balancing, for example, the mass of a tree with the mass of a cloud, and used light and shade to make a definite pattern. Their intention was not to portray a landscape, but to create a work of art. It was a deliberate composition. In their arrangement of the facts of nature, they were satisfied if they did not outrage the spectator's sense of reality. It was left for the impressionists to paint what they saw. They tried to catch nature in its fleeting beauty. They were content to render the radiance of sunlight, the color of shadows, or the translucency of the air. They aimed at truth. They wanted a painter to be no more than an eye and a hand. They despised intelligence. It is strange how empty their paintings look now when you place them beside the stately pictures of Claude. The method of Claude is the method of that master of the short story, Guy de Maupassant. It's a very good one, and I have a notion that it will survive the other. Already it's getting a little difficult to care much what middle-class Russians were like 50 years ago, and the anecdote in Chekhov's stories is not, as a rule, absorbing enough. As the story of Paolo and Francesca, or of Macbeth, is absorbing. To hold your attention apart from your interest in the people. The method of which I speak is that which chooses from life what is curious, telling, and dramatic. It does not seek to copy life, but keeps to it closely enough not to shock the reader into disbelief. It leaves out this and changes that. It makes a formal decoration out of such of the facts as it has found convenient to deal with, and presents a picture, the result of artifice, which, because it represents the author's temperament, is to a certain extent a portrait of himself, but which is designed to excite, interest, and absorb the reader. If it is a success, he accepts it as true. I've written all this in order to impress upon the reader that this book is a work of fiction, though I should say not much more so than several of the books on the same subject that have appeared during the last few years and that purport to be truthful memoirs. The work of an agent in the intelligence department is, on the whole, extremely monotonous. A lot of it is uncommonly useless. The material it offers for stories is scrappy and pointless. The author has himself to make it coherent, dramatic, and probable. In 1917, I went to Russia. I was sent to prevent the Bolshevik Revolution and to keep Russia in the war. The reader will know that my efforts did not meet with success. I went to Petrograd from Vladivostok. One day, on the way through Siberia, the train stopped at some station and the passengers, as usual, got out, some to fetch water to make tea, some to buy food, and others to stretch their legs. A blind soldier was sitting on a bench. Other soldiers sat beside him, and more stood behind. There were from 20 to 30. Their uniforms were torn and stained. The blind soldier, a big, vigorous fellow, was quite young. On his cheeks was the soft, pale down of a beard that has never been shaved. I dare say he wasn't 18. He had a broad face with flat, wide features, and on his forehead was a great scar of the wound that had cost him his sight. His closed eyes gave him a strangely vacant look. He began to sing. His voice was strong and sweet. He accompanied himself on an accordion. The train waited on, and he sang song after song. I couldn't understand his words, but through his singing, wild and melancholy, I seemed to hear the cry of the oppressed. I felt the lonely steppes and the interminable forests, the flow of the broad Russian rivers, and all the toil of the countryside, the plowing of the land and the reaping of the ripe corn, the sighing of the wind in the birch trees, the long months of dark winter, and then the dancing of women in the villages, and the youths bathing in shallow streams on summer evenings. I felt the horror of war, the bitter nights in the trenches, the long marches on muddy roads, the battlefield with its terror and anguish and death. It was horrible and deeply moving. A cap lay at the singer's feet, and the passengers filled it full of money. The same emotion had seized them all, of boundless compassion and of vague horror, for there was something in that blind, scarred face that was terrifying. You felt that this was a being apart, sundered from joy of the enchanting world. He did not seem quite human. The soldiers stood silent and hostile. Their attitude seemed to claim as a right the alms of the traveling herd. There was a disdainful anger on their side and immeasurable pity on ours, but no glimmering of a sense that there was but one way to compensate that helpless man for all his pain. Ashendon, or the British agent. Chapter 1. R. It was not till the beginning of September that Ashenden, a writer by profession, who had been abroad at the outbreak of the war, managed to get back to England. He chanced soon after his arrival to go to a party and was there introduced to a middle-aged colonel whose name he didn't catch. He had some talk with him. As he was about to leave, this officer came up to him and asked, "I say, I wonder if you'd mind coming to see me. I'd rather like to have a chat with you."
"Certainly," said Ashenden. "Whenever you like."
"What about tomorrow at 11?
"All right.
I'll just write down my address. Have you a card on you?" Ashenden gave him one, and on this the colonel scribbled in pencil the name of a street and the number of a house. When Ashenden walked along next morning to keep his appointment, he found himself in a street of rather vulgar red brick houses in a part of London that had once been fashionable, but was now fallen in the esteem of the house hunter who wanted a good address. On the house at which Ashenden had been asked to call, there was a board up to announce that it was for sale. The shutters were closed, and there was no sign that anyone lived in it. He rang the bell, and the door was opened by a non-commissioned officer so promptly that he was startled. He was not asked his business, but led immediately into a long room at the back, once evidently a dining room, the florid decoration of which looked oddly out of keeping with the office furniture, shabby and sparse, that was in it. It gave Ashenden the impression of a room in which the brokers had taken possession. The colonel, who was known in the intelligence department, as Ashenden later discovered, by the letter R, rose when he came in and shook hands with him. He was a man somewhat above the middle height, lean, and with a yellow, deeply lined face, thin gray hair, and a toothbrush mustache. The thing immediately noticeable about him was the closeness with which his blue eyes were set. He only just escaped a squint. They were hard and cruel eyes, and very wary, and they gave him a cunning, shifty look. Here was a man that you could neither like nor trust at first sight. His manner was pleasant and cordial. He asked Ashenden a good many questions, and then, without further to do, suggested that he had particular qualifications for the Secret Service. Ashenden was acquainted with several European languages, and his profession was excellent cover. On the pretext that he was writing a book, he could, without attracting attention, visit any neutral country. It was while they were discussing this point that R. said, "You know, you ought to get material that would be very useful to you in your work."
"I shouldn't mind that," said Ashenden.
"I'll tell you an incident that occurred only the other day, and I can vouch for its truth. I thought at the time it would make a damn good story. One of the French ministers went down to Nice to recover from a cold, and he had some very important documents with him that he kept in a dispatch case. They were very important indeed. Well, a day or two after he arrived, he picked up a yellow-haired lady at some restaurant or other where there was dancing, and he got very friendly with her. To cut a long story short, he took her back to his hotel. Of course, it was a very imprudent thing to do, and when he came to himself in the morning, the lady and the dispatch case had disappeared. They had one or two drinks up in his room, and his theory is that when his back was turned, the woman slipped a drug into his glass." R. finished and looked at Ashenden with a gleam in his close-set eyes.
"Dramatic, isn't it?" he asked.
"Do you mean to say that happened the other day?"
"The week before last."
"Impossible," cried Ashenden. "Why, we've been putting that incident on the stage for 60 years. We've written it in 1,000 novels. Do you mean to say that life has only just caught up with us?"
R. was a trifle disconcerted.
"Well, if necessary, I could give you names and dates. And believe me, the Allies have been put to no end of trouble by the loss of the documents that the dispatch case contained."
"Well, sir, if you can't do better than that in the Secret Service," sighed Ashenden, "I'm afraid that, as a source of inspiration to the writer of fiction, it's a washout. We really can't write that story much longer." It didn't take them long to settle things. And when Ashenden rose to go, he had already made careful note of his instructions. He was to start for Geneva next day. The last words that R said to him, with a casualness that made them impressive, were, "There's just one thing I think you ought to know before you take on this job, and don't forget it. If you do well, you'll get no thanks, and if you get into trouble, you'll get no help. Does that suit you?" "Perfectly." "Then I'll wish you good afternoon."